I'm Chris Vanderklok, the chair of the U3A Manawatū, and I'd like to welcome you to the first of our spring series talks on linguistics and languages. Our presenters for this series all belong to the School of Humanities, Media and Creative Communication at Massey University. Let me begin by thanking the City Library for providing a lovely venue. It's good to see a good-sized crowd with us today. Now, the Spanish program at Massey was started in 1996, and since then it has engaged with schools and with the wider public quite a lot, probably more than most programs, I think, to promote awareness of Hispanic language and culture. And it even teaches students, Australian students, through an arrangement with the University of New England in Armidale, New South Wales. So today we have two speakers from the Spanish program, Francisco González Bonilla from Colombia and Dr. Maria Selena Bortolotto from Argentina. Welcome. Selena's research explores the interrelation between cultural values and individual emotions, especially shame and humour, as represented in contemporary Latin American literary fiction from the Caribbean, Latin America, and the United States. She also researches emotion and motivation in second language teaching and learning. Selena teaches courses on advanced Spanish language, translation, Spanish phonetics, and Hispanic literature. Francisco is a senior tutor in Spanish with over 25 years' experience of language teaching. He teaches courses on language, Hispanic cinema, and heritage and culture, and also he'll be back at the end of the series to talk about art in the Hispanic world. Please welcome our speakers, Selena and Francisco, who will talk about how Spanish came to be.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Chris, for the introduction, and my former colleague. And thanks very much, Stuart, for the invitation. We appreciate that. And thank you. Thanks, everyone, for being here. This first talk of the series about Español, Spanish, international language. I would say probably the fourth most spoken language in the world. Of course, we have English, the first one. And Hindi, yeah, and Mandarin, and then comes Spanish. I'd like to highlight a couple of things about, probably you know this, but it's important to highlight this at the beginning, is one, every single language has a history, a constant history of meetings, encounters, yes? Historical encounters, I mean, respond to conquest, colonization, migration, massive migration, as we have been experiencing in this 21st century. And then comes the second point, which is related to that historical process, and is the topic of or the characteristic of constant evolution. Every single language is always moving, no? And growing. And that's the case with English. I just realized, reading about it, that few words from New Zealand, even Te Reo Maori, in English, has been included in the Oxford English Dictionary. This year, sweet ass, as you know, Morena, and Lucy Bro. Last year, Waka Jumper, officially recognized, no, in English language. And it keeps going. It has been 11, I have to say, in the last 2 years, 11 words from New Zealand included in the Oxford Dictionary. And that's the case with Spanish as well, no? And nowadays, because of the massive migration from Central America, Mexico, Puerto Rico, Spanish is becoming a big thing in the world. Music and everything. I'd like to start referring to the beginnings. The very beginnings, I'm going to move to Iberia, the peninsula, Spain. And I like to talk about the first settlers. Yes, the first record of people living in La Peninsula. Right on the top, Cantabria, next to the Basque Country. In the case of Altamira, were found some paintings. This is prehistoric, Paleolithic people. Yes, used to live there. And those are the paintings, 22,000 years ago. Yes. As you see, toros, the bull, start to be the main character, representation in Hispanic world. Not just in the north, but also in the south. Yes? 22,000 years ago, I said, and they have, even if prehistoric human beings, let's say, there was already a vocal, oral capacity to communicate, not just to paint. So they start to name these animals, and the main one especially, toros. If we go back to the original settlers, before the Carthaginian conquest, we have some groups here. Celtics, coming from the north, Gaelic language, North Sea, yes. Iberian, called Iberian because they were near the Ebo River. And Ebo, as we will see a bit, in a bit, Phoenician language means water, people living by the water. Original Basque, and some other groups. One characteristic of these groups, they were extended families, basically, isolated. They don't have contact with each other. They were loyal to the chieftain, to the family, and trying to protect against the aggression of others, right? So there was no common language by this time. Let's move on. However, there was some contact here between Ibericos and the Celts, and we start to define so few first words of communications which came in Spanish, Dama, but in English. They are related, coming from that period. Lit, summon, vassal, and visage. Yes? That's the root. Celta Iberico. Celts. Then came Minoans from Crete, Crete Island, and then the Greek. Sorry, I'm going back because I need to mention this. The Mare Nostrum, Mediterranean Sea, it was the entrance, the most important body of water, and it was the gate to the Atlantic Sea. So the fundamental thing was to have control of the Mediterranean Sea by the time. from Crete, the Minoans took control of the coast, and eventually Minoans becoming the Greek ones. Sorry. As I mentioned before, the Greeks start to define some words. Ebro River, people living by the water, and become Iberia, and nowadays it's still Iberia, no? Iberic Peninsula. Works from the Greek system, program, theme, anagram, problem, olive, beat, related to the trade, no? Of course, the Greek has the agreement system, philosophy, so there was a lot of influence from other parts, but there is a linguistic already, there is a linguistic influence already. The Greek found two cities, Gadir, which is Cadiz nowadays, the world city, meaning the world city in Greek, and Malacca, the emporium, market or factory place, which is Malaga nowadays. Yes. And then comes another group. 15,000 years ago, coming from what is nowadays Lebanon, Phoenicians. You will see there the trade route, copper, olives, oil, some minerals from the south, no, was part of the trade. Main Phoenician cities, and then Cadiz and Malaga as main centers. The Phoenicians defined as the name of the country. Spain, meaning remote place or land full of rabbits. Yeah. Irish, Spain, España. That's the first word, very important word defined by the Phoenicians. Let's move on. And then the words, yes, taking control, important, having control of the Mediterranean Sea, of the trade, of the area, it was fundamental, no? Phoenicians basically eventually became the Carthaginians. No. I've been taking control of the same area, no? And assuming and learning a lot from the Phoenicians. And Cartago, no? As the main center. We see all this influence from the Mediterranean cultures. They have control of the south coast of Spain. That's the fundamental area, no? To take control of. However, it was more or less between 500 BC and around this period of time when a specific group coming from this peninsula here, Calcio area, near Rome. Family, extended family with a unique language, Latin, armed themselves, start to grow, and start taking control of the peninsula, declaring eventually war. To the Carthaginians, and this is the period called the Punic Wars, no? Hannibal against the Latin ones. You see, North Africa, South Spain, and this is the area of the Italian peninsula here, including Sicily. That's the war zone, let's call that, no, between the Carthaginians and the Romans. But the Romans won. The Romans won. And they became their big empire. Basically, once they won, the purpose now was taking control of the peninsula. That's the most important, because that's the gate of the Mediterranean. And this, that's when they start to not just taking the north of Africa and the south of the peninsula, but they start to grow everywhere. You know, the Romans went to the north of England, north of the border, down to part of the Middle East, and became a huge empire. There are many characteristics about the Romans. First is the language, the Latin, unique language. But also, they develop and they learn from other cultures. But they became engineers. That's the most important thing. Start to build roads, connections, bridges. And they learn, and they, from the Greek, philosophy, Stoicism, playwrights, theaters, aqueducts in Segovia, and they have the concept not of farm, not of feudal system, but of township. I have to say, we are proud of living in a Roman city here in New Zealand, with a plaza, a square. Probably, I don't know how many, but we have a beautiful plaza with a city council, right? That's Roman concept, to have an administration. So the unit was not the farm anymore, but the township, people gathering around a town. And then we start to have the influence of the Latin language. You see? Attic, marriage, goat, memorize, previous, punish, and so on. At this point, I'd like to mention that still the Spanish language has 55%, or is 55% around that, Latin, Roman. English could be around 30%. There are other influences, no? Germanic influence in English and so on, but the Spanish, the fundamental, the base, is Roman, Latin, the vulgar Latin, not the Vatican one, but the vulgar Latin. Building roads, building bridges, means having control of the whole peninsula, military control. Iberia became Hispania in 270 BC. It was nearly 900 years of Roman influence in Spain. Yes. Ruled by the Roman emperors and having, so just and I have to mention this because it's important, you know, Constantine and Helen, his mother became Christian at some point, no? Nearly 330 AD. So Christianity came with the Romans to Spain, and Christianity also means to have a code, civil code, commandments, law, eventually law. No? That's part of also the influence. But the language in Spain became Latin at this time. Romans or Latin people, probably now it's not that different, but love, good life, wine, good cheese, yeah, a lot of corruption in the empire. And at some point, some groups from Germany start to come, the Goths, Visigoths, and start to take control some areas of Barcelona, mainly Barcelona area, Catalonia area. So we have Recaredo, the god, the king Recaredo, which is a Visigoth, and they have some influences, some few words in Spanish come, and eventually in English as well, no? From the Visigoths' influence. Having the good life, and surprise, surprise, a new messenger, Muhammad, a new religion is born, and came from the south, the invasion of the Moorish in 711 CE. That's the time when everything changed. New culture, new religion, Islam, new concept for our living. This is a long period of dispute, wars. Wars everywhere in the peninsula, and Islam starts to spread out. Everywhere. Iberia, Hispania became Al-Andalus. Changed the name. And the language started to change. And the food started to change. And then came rice. And then came horses. And then came sugar and cotton and new architecture. Al-Andalus. The numerical system changed as well. Algebra, concept of zero. And we start to have words. And in Spanish, I have to say, almost every single word starting with A or A-L comes from Arabic language. Nowadays, it's nearly the 30%. Not 25-30%. Of words comes from Arabic language and Spanish. That's the difference between French and Italian. They don't have this. 783 years of Arabic presence. Yes? French and Italian, they are Romance language, Latin, but they don't have the Arabic influence. Probably you have been there, the beautiful architecture of the south of Spain mainly, Alhambra in Granada, el Alcázar de Sevilla, so new patterns, new concept of beauty. The irrigation systems are new, you know Spain is quite dry, especially in the south. concept of neighborhood. The mosque of Mezquitas in Cordoba, and the Jules is still there. And at this point, sorry, I have to. I use 783 years of presence Arabic, but local people never quite accept that to change to Islam from Christianity, from Catholicism. So it was an ongoing battle, and it's that called the reconquest of Spain. 7 centuries of fighting. But finally, Christians won. This is a painting by Francisco Padilla, and this is the final surrender. Muhammad the 12th surrendering to Isabella and Ferdinand, King and Queen of Spain. 1492. That's the time when everything changes. 1492. I will mention this. Isabella came from this kingdom, Castilla. Ferdinand came from Aragon. They have different languages, but related to Latin, same root. There were some other languages, no? Galician, Catalan, but once they got married in 1478, they agreed to have the language from Castilla, which is called Castellano, Castilian, as the official language of the whole peninsula. They invite the cousins to join the party here once they get married, and they say no, thank you. That's when Portugal became Portugal, and they kept the language Portuguese. Finally, the Muslims have to cross Gibraltar and go back to the north of Africa, and Spain became Spain in the sense that became Christian at the particular moment, and they assumed the language as the Castilian language. It's in that moment when people in Spain, even if they eat Arabic food, they dress as a Arabic or Muslim people, they start to, we call this the de-Arabization of the peninsula. Yeah. The words were there, but they start to change it to Mukadas, Almohad, or Almohada, means pillow. And it's a common process in the Spanish language, no? Many, many words has the Arabic root, but became something else, something new. Probably at this point, I will pass the word to my colleague Selena, because this is the moment when Castilian is going to change again. Official language is going to change, because in 1492, a crazy guy called Christopher Columbus came with an odd idea, and the odd idea became a reality. A new continent, America.
Thank you. I feel like you were taking us. We were on a boat, on a waka, canoa, we were sailing through history. It's really interesting because Columbus was not a native speaker of Spanish. He was Italian, from Genoa, Genovese. So what's crucial at this point in history is he was supposed to find the Genghis Khan. That was his promise to the kings. That's why they financed or funded his expedition. He, as an academic, as a New Zealand academic getting funding, he had to provide written reports of what he had found, and what he was looking for was this wonderful kingdom of richness, splendor. He found an island, lots of vegetation, mosquitoes, heat, no gold, friendly people. So it was through language, this broken Spanish, that he had to convey to the king and queen, Ferdinand and Isabella. He had to convince them that the expedition had been successful. So this sort of epistolar narrative of wonders in which Columbus was promising. He didn't have anything to show. He hadn't found gold, but he had to promise that gold was near, that he was about to find it, that people were beautiful, that there must be gold somewhere. So it's very, very interesting to read his diaries. And that's why I make a comparison with academics. I'm talking about myself, of course. This promise of greatness to come all the time, because it wasn't there. It wasn't what he was expecting. He was expecting to arrive in Asia. And he arrived in this new land of friendly people. So, lost, trying to name things, trying to make sense of what they saw. For example, pineapples. What's this? Okay, it's edible. It looks like a pine cone. Okay, piña. Piña. Pine cone in Spanish. And pineapple. No? You begin to name what you see, which is so different with what you know, trying to find similarity, correspondences, not always possible. So many different peoples, so many different languages. Very interesting that they arrive in a small island in the Caribbean, that's where they land, with a name in a Taíno, one of the groups living in the Caribbean, in the Taíno language. Nobody really knows for certain today where he landed, because they didn't understand the name. They say Hispaniola, Santo Domingo, but it's not 100% certain. So this sort of parallel world between the Spanish, the conquerors, conquistadores, and the peoples who were living there is all the time there. This sort of gap in between what they understand or make sense and what the people see. There's this famous story about understanding what you see in terms of what you know. And there's the famous anecdote of the Taínos not seeing the carabelas, the ships, on the water. It's not that they didn't see them. They couldn't comprehend because they hadn't ever seen anything like it. So this scenario was one of the keys to understand the conquest. Also the fact that the conquest was as much a process of blood and violence as of bureaucracy. So language. Spain had quite a tight control over the expanding empire in the Americas through bureaucracy. all these documents, royal documents that they had to sign and write and post and stamp. These, look at the different colors. These were the most important languages before the arrival of the Spanish. This is after. And you see, some groups have been able to keep languages going strong, for example, Quechuas in the Andes. Countries like Bolivia, for example, Ecuador to some extent, had made it a responsibility and part of the policy, national policy, to keep the language and keep it strong at schools. Quechua, for example, in the Andes. Guarani, which is not so significant in the map, but it's a very, very strong language, not only in Paraguay, but also in the northeast of Argentina. That variety, in many ways of seeing the world, unfortunately, have been lost. First American word incorporated to the Spanish dictionary, canoa, canoe in English, no? This boat out of a single log from the islands, made of a ceiba tree. That's where the Taínos went to welcome the Spanish, in canoas. So words from indigenous languages that we have in Spanish, and you will recognize most of them. Alpaca, the animal. Coca, the plant. Cóndor. Pampa. Puma. Quinoa, poncho, gaucho, guano, all from Quichua or Quechua. Quichua, the Quichua system, phonetic system, only has three vowels, A, I, U. That's why, for example, in Argentina we have a lot of immigration from Bolivia, especially Bolivia and Peru, and their native language in many cases is Quechua. Or Quichua, they tend to transform the E into I and the O into U. No? Niño instead of niño, boy. Nahuatl, indigenous language in Mexico. We have a lot of words from Nahuatl that have to do with food. Great additions to the language. Well, not coyote, but chocolate, aguacate, tomate, mole, chicle, chewing gum. These are interesting, the ate words from Nahuatl, because in fact, and I'll show you, I don't know if it's the next one, let me see. I'll jump and come back. Yeah. In Nahuatl, the words end in to, which is not an ending in Spanish, in our phonetics. We don't have that ending in our language phonetically. So the phonetic transcription to Spanish takes a vowel, because the basic nucleus of Spanish sounds phonetically is the vowel. So for example, even words that are very similar in the two languages, English and Spanish, for example, a word like telephone in English teléfono in Spanish. In English, vowels tend to disappear if they're weak or become simplified. So in English, telephone. In Spanish, teléfono, one syllable more. Inteligente, in English, intelligent, intelligent, or intelligent. In Spanish, inteligente, more syllables. Because we never simplify the vowel. We need the vowel as the nucleus of the language. So these words ending in tl got the e, the central vowel. Chocolate, chocolato, became chocolate. Aguacato, aguacate, avocado. Tamali, tamal, and the rest. From Arawak, some more words: barbacoa, canoa, huracán, tabaco, maíz. And they have to do, of course, with the regions. No? Quichua, the Andes, Nahuatl, Mexico, the central, Arawak, the Caribbean, no? The north of America, of South America. Mapuche, or Mapundung, the Andes in the south, Chile and Argentina, Mapuche, Malón, the group, combative group of Mapuche warriors. Poncho, laucha, small mouse. Pucho, cigarette. Gualicho, a spell. From Guarani, northeast of Argentina and Paraguay. Jaguar, no, the big cat. Tucán. Tapera, an empty abandoned house. Mandioca. From other cultures, gives to Spain in America. From African roots, tango. The origin of the word, it's a bit, there's no agreement. It seems to come from the place where some African groups got together to play the drums and dance and be together. Tambo, tango, sounds of drums. So, I teach translation, and one of the topics in our course is false friends, no? False friends or falsos amigos. Words that sound very similar in English and in Spanish, but do not mean the same. As Francisco was saying, English does have an influence from Latin, but not directly from the Romans. Because after the Romans left, the Celtic language prevailed, or the Celtic dialects prevailed on the islands. But Latin came back to England, or to English, through William the Conqueror, through the French court in 1066. So it came back, and French became the language of power, the language of the court, the language of the king, the language of the law. And it's interesting because, for example, in English, peasants were Anglo-Saxons, so the animals, cow, pig, sheep, became for the court the French word that you still keep for the food. So the pig for food is porc, and that's the name of the food in English. Now, the sheep, mouton, became for food mutton. And which one am I missing? Beef, bœuf in French became beef, from cow to beef. So the aristocrats never saw the animal live, so the peasants called them cow, sheep, or pig. But the aristocrats saw them as food, and that's the name that they still keep in English. So the Latin influence comes to English through French. And that's the way some of the words that we have almost exactly in common with English, but not quite, in Spanish come directly from Latin. In English, they come to English via French, and they differ. We have, for example, exit. In Spanish, it comes directly from Latin, exitus, as output. Production, success. In English, exit comes from Latin as a verb. He goes out, she goes out. So, salida, no? Going out. Another one, for example, embarrassed. A tricky one. If you say I'm embarrassed, people will look at your belly. Because embarazada is pregnant. So, it's interesting because embarrassed, they both come from Latin, but in Spanish, embarazada comes from Portuguese or Leonese. So Portuguese a language, Leonese a dialect. They come from Latin, but already modified, and it means obstruct, hinder, or hindered. In English, it's a similar meaning through Old French. Hinder, obstructed, blocked, and it becomes blocked as embarrassed, as shame, right? Self-conscious. Okay, I'll leave this here, and I'll give you something to work. I'm a teacher, so I like students to work.
You will have to do it in groups. I don't have enough. You'll have to work in groups. I'll give you one, work as a group. I'll give you another one. Try to see if you can put them together. There's the trouble. I only have three, so you have to move around. Try to see if you can put them together. The Spanish, the English. You can put them on a chair. Let's see if you can find out what they mean. No, you need to put them together. Try to look for the one that goes with the other. Which one goes with the other? Would you build a pair? Try to find the correct translation. It's not the one that you would think. They're all tricky words. Ropa, for example, ropa is not robe. Okay. Is that it? Okay, I'll take you this. Okay, cartoon. How do we say cartoon in Spanish? Cartoon. Remember that these are all tricky words. They are not what they seem. Cartoon. Dibujo animado. Animated drawing would be the literal translation. Dibujo animado. That's how we say cartoon in Spanish. Okay, dibujo animado, animated drawing. Okay, the next one. Verb. It's not ropa. Rope, cuerda. Very nice pronunciation, well done. Cuerda is rope. And how do we say? What is ropa in Spanish? What is ropa? Clothes. Muy bien. Idiom. What is idiom in Spanish? Modismo. Sí, o frase, o idiom. Darse cuenta. Darse cuenta. What's that in English? Darse cuenta. To realize or notice. Muy bien. Yeah.
assist. Very similar to asistir, but it's not the meaning. Assist. Ayudar, muy bien. Ayudar, to help. ¿Sí? Ayudar, to assist. Asistir, in Spanish, is to attend. Like you today. Asistir a un evento. Attend an event. ¿Sí?
They are very tricky. Okay, the last one, because we need to go.
Embarrassed. Embarrassed is avergonzado, from vergüenza, shame. Not embarazada. How do we say embarazada in English? Pregnant. See? So not embarazada. Embarazada. Muy bien. Okay. Questions? I know. We wanted to finish. See? Spanish coming to New Zealand in the 70s with quite a big wave, over 350 families from Chile fleeing the military coup, Pinochet's government, coming to New Zealand to bring a little bit of Spanish. Now everybody knows what hola is, chocolate, salsa, guacamole, okay? Tortilla. And then the last thing to say about what Francisco was saying before, the language being alive all the time, we are alive, language is alive, changing. In Spanish, there is a strong movement in the last 5 to 8 years to abandon, what do you do with the marker? To abandon the marker, the masculine gender. You know that in Spanish, words, all words have a gender, which doesn't make things easy for our students at all. All words have a gender, completely arbitrary. Moon is she. Car is he. El. Moon is la. In French, car is she. La voiture. So it's completely arbitrary. So now there's a big movement spurred by feminism and embraced by the general public to some extent, to abandon the masculine as the generic gender. So in Spanish, you, if I'm speaking about you, where there are his and she's, I would say ellos. I would use the masculine as the generic. Now, there's a very strong movement to replace ellos. The O is the marker for masculine gender in Spanish, to replace this with E, which is common in French. So instead of speaking about ellos, to say ellas. Do I use it? No. Not yet. But it's gaining momentum, so maybe 10, 20 years, we'll have to say ellas with A. No? Language is alive. Thank you. Thank you. Gracias.
Okay, we've got tea, coffee, biscuits there. We'll have a very short break. If you've got questions that you want to write down, there's paper and pen with Ian at the table over there. Okay, we're nearly all back, and time is running on. So if we move straight on to the questions, we have somehow one written question, so we can address that, and then I'll open it to the floor, and I have a roving mic for anyone. Yes, that one. Yes. Oh, we got two questions?
Yeah.
We have two questions.
Two? Okay, two questions. You want to have some of these? No, you can read them out yourselves.
Yes. So the first one, Francisco will answer that one.
At what stage did the spoken language become written language also?
Is it
Standardization, right?
Standardization. Mm-hmm. Basically, it came with the process of reconquest. Once the Christians start to retake the land from the Moorish, immediately they start, they were conscious of the effort to have a written language. And that's when they start to write the first dictionaries. Yes? And Alfonso the Wise, which is Alfonso the X of Castile, was the leader, or the main figure of this. In 13th century, he started to write, which is called the Castellano, yeah, to record this as a proper book, a proper dictionary. That's the first one. 13th century became written.
Yeah, I just want to add to this that in a sort of an analogous way to what I was explaining about the conquest, as you all know, having a same language, standardizing the language, helps union, right? So, for example, that was the idea of Ferdinand and Isabella, to keep control, to create a united kingdom, and for that they needed a common language. In a country which, even today, we may not think of Spain as a plurilingual country, but it is very much so, because people speak Catalan, Basque in the north, Aragonese, another language similar to Catalan, Gallego. So there are lots of languages in Spain, but united through Spanish. That's why, for example, under the government of Franco, his dictatorship, regional languages were suppressed. So Catalans could not speak Catalan. They had to speak Spanish. And so, no, the regions, as a way to keep in control. And the second question, which is very interesting too, how quickly South American Spanish evolving away from Spanish in Spain? I would make the region a bit bigger and include North America. North America is becoming very quickly almost the most prominent cultural node of Hispanic culture because of the quantity of speakers in the United States. And the interesting phenomenon that is taking place is what Francisco was saying before, Spanglish. Espanglish. And so we start, especially California, Texas, California, Texas, so the West, South, Florida, big New York with Puerto Rico, Puerto Ricans. So we have phrases like this that appear in Spanglish. Vacunar la carpeta. That comes from English. Vacunar, the real meaning in Spanish of vacunar is to vaccinate. So, a correct translation into normative Spanish would be vaccinate the folder. Carpeta is folder in normative Spanish. But in fact, what does this mean in English? Vacuum the carpet. The correct translation into normative Spanish would be aspirar la alfombra. That this is an Arabic word. Remember that Francisco was telling you that words that start with A-L? This is an Arabic word. So this is the correct translation into normative Spanish. Aspirar, no? The vacuum cleaner. Aspirar la alfombra. That's the normative Spanish. Spanish speakers say vacunar la carpeta, and they understand what they mean. We don't. I'm not fluent in Spanish, so it's quite hard to understand. Will it become, so the debate now with linguists is, will it become a language on its own, or will it become a dialect of Spanish? Let's see, time will say.
And officially, it's 50 million people, Hispanic community in the United States, speaking Spanish now. 50 million people, which is quite well known.
So compared to South America, it's still intelligible to speak.
Yes, South America is not so. In South America, we don't. We have a strong penetration of English, especially in urban centers. But we import the word in English.
But is it intelligible to Spanish speakers from Spain, the South American
dialects? Yes. Except for, and this is interesting, the most idiosyncratic variations in dialect, in between dialects, is food. So, for example, for the same food, we have 4 or 5 different names according to the country, and you may not understand if you are not familiar with the name.
Could you tell similar stories about French and multiple languages in that area that is now dominated by one, and also, say, Italy and Germany? You know, in Spain, you said there were all the different languages in different parts, but
yes,
then it was merged and sort of condensed, and some of the fringe languages were suppressed. Has there been similar things in parts of Italy and France? And
I don't know about Italy. I'm sorry, I don't know about
Italy. Italy has a lot of false friends.
Yeah.
For example, the word for a book is a libro.
Yeah.
A libreria is a library, not a bookshop. So,
yeah.
But Italy took a very long time to unite as a nation.
Yeah.
So dialects are very prominent in Italy.
Still prominent.
Many of the immigrants to Argentina, for example, didn't speak good Italian. They spoke that dialect.
Yep. The language was unified by people from Florence, because they had the printing press in whatever, 1871. And the law was that the kids should all learn Italian at school. But in the south, the kids worked. They didn't go to school necessarily. And it was only in the Second World War when Italians, the men from all over Italy, went off, and they couldn't understand the people in charge because they were speaking Italian and the others were still in dialect. So it's been a law since the war, 1945, that everybody learned Italian.
In Argentina, for example, in the center of Argentina, Córdoba, a very rich province in the center of Argentina, great university, great public university, many of people from Piemonte, the Piedmont, places of the mountains, immigrated to Argentina, and they spoke Piemontese, the dialect. They didn't speak Italian, per se, or very basic Italian. A bit like, for example, people from the north in Argentina, they speak Quechua. Their Spanish is a bit sketchy. So they speak Spanish to deal with paperwork and. But otherwise,
yeah. I think even in Britain, with the military, sometimes they had similar problems. You know, going back 150 years, people from different parts of Britain.
It was really interesting. I'm from the Patagonia, the south of Argentina, and there's a strong presence of Welsh people, Galeses. No, they established colonies near the sea, in Patagonia. Towns that are practically Welsh, and they teach English, right? But many of the students spoke only Quechua, from Bolivian immigrants that went to Patagonia to do horticulture. And so the English teachers had to learn a little bit of Quechua, because they couldn't teach English through Spanish, because these children did not speak Spanish at home.
Given how you've seen how languages are obviously evolve over time, and it's an ongoing process, we've got various issues in New Zealand with bringing in other languages, including Te Reo. How do you see that develop? Do you see it being a big influence? Do you see it limiting communication or things like that?
Well, for us, it's
it's a growing process.
It's a fight, it's an ongoing struggle to sort of expand. It's more a mentality, right? Abandon, because I mean, it's true. If you know English, you're fine. It's true. But the thing that you lose if you don't learn another language is a whole world, a whole way of seeing.
But also, is New Zealand English changing because we bring in more Maori words into English?
Yes.
And it's also the process of identity of English.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that story because, for example, young couples that have been coming, immigrating from Colombia or Argentina, who know English quite well, maybe English from the US or from Great Britain, which is the English that we are taught, they're a bit confronted because they come here and they hear kai, kiora, koha, and they're like, okay, I don't know those words. Am I supposed to know those words? Like kai, kiora, koha, namihi, haremai. Yes, you are supposed to know them here. They are part of here. So it is a different language. Yeah. It is a New Zealand English.
Yeah. Okay. Any questions from the floor?
Just one question, because we stopped.
Oh. We stopped with Isabella Ferdinand. So was there a lot of, or any other influence since that time on the Spanish language in Spain, or was that from then on unified, it was standardized, and it pretty much didn't move forward too much from there? Was there any other immigration?
No, it was unified, because basically when we started the 19th century, the dictatorship, Franco's dictatorship, started quite soon. It was nearly 50 years of compulsory Castilian to Spanish.
In between there, 1500 to...
Oh, the wars coming from America.
Immigrants coming from America.
Everything changed, because everything was coming... Basically, Spain stopped producing after the discovery. They stopped producing... stop producing food. So all these products, tomato, potato, tomato, everything. So there was the new diet, but also new words for Spain. No? So there was the variety, or the new thing was all the influence coming from America backwards, not to Spain. That's basically.
Yes, all those words that I was showing you, poncho, gaucho, laucha, so all those words came back to Spain, to Spanish. But it's interesting because, as you were saying, of course language is alive, and now, for example, some new words are being coined, particularly food, in the coast of Spain, because of British, German, and Nordic people who retire and go to live in the coast of Spain, and they want food that they know. So restaurants have been changing their menus. So new words are being coined as we speak, with new menus, new meals that are imported into Spanish from those countries.
When did Portugal move away from?
Oh, it was Spanish. After, I say, 1478, they got married, Ferdinand and Isabella.
Yes.
And they invite the rest to join.
And their language.
And the language. They say, no, we are going to be. And even if they were relatives, they were cousins to Isabella, but they say, no. I mean, the monarchy, no? The local monarchy was of Portugal. So it was.
Did they go peaceful? They said, "No, we're going to be Portugal."
Yeah, because they were tired of fighting for centuries. And basically, they had no means to carry on fighting.
You want to but the coastal language, which became Portuguese, remained very similar up north with Gallego. Gallego is very similar to Portuguese.
Right. And it has the Arabic influence as well, you know, like Italian or French.
Was there one more question? No? Okay. No. That's good, because I've got a car park out there that's going to be at 3 o'clock and I've got to load up some things in it first. Okay, that was excellent. Thank you very much indeed. I think all the story about evolution of language and history and the processes that are still going on, and what it suggested also was, I mean, there's a lot of talk about indigenous population, and the way you describe it, what on earth, certainly in Europe, what on earth is an indigenous population? And when you hear, or there were the Romans doing this, but you find a lot of cities in Italy that became part of Rome were actually Greek settlements and so on. All the mixtures. So, and it's an ongoing process that's happening all the time. So, fascinating stories, and there's a lot more about it, and a lot been written, looking way back in history at how these things evolved, and how you, mentioned during the break, there's a book, I'll plug it anyway, The Horse, the Wheel and Language, talking about going back, or maybe 9, 10, 15,000 years ago, how you could use language and the way words have translated from one area to another as an indication of movements of people and the way people's mix. And you've really touched on a lot of that sort of thing here. There's a massive story there and a lot we can learn from it. So, on behalf of U3A, a small thank you to both of you. You actually deserve a lot, a much bigger one. This has been excellent. Thank you very much indeed. We're looking forward to it.